It's always a presentation of the Myers Automotive Group. How are you doing this morning, Mike?
Good morning. I had a very, very similar experience. I made it to 4-2, and I'm like, oh, well, you know, they're going to make it interesting, but they're going to lose again, and it's another tough loss, and given all the gong show that's been going on there, should be an interesting day tomorrow. And then I woke up, and I'm like, what? What? How did that happen? So I guess it's that kind of year. I mean, there's been some wild comebacks, and I don't know if it's just a stay of the inevitable in Vancouver, but it does seem to be that they are in a bit of turmoil, much of it self-made, which is the concerning part, I guess, if you're a Canucks fan.
Yeah, Jimmy Rutherford is usually brought into situations like he was in Pittsburgh to help put a team over the top. And now in Vancouver, it doesn't look like they have the team to do that. And is he, at his age and everything, is he the right guy to overlook a rebuild, if that's indeed what, a teardown and a rebuild? I don't know. The whole thing kind of just doesn't make sense. All the way the pieces are all fit together, it just looks inevitable that it's all going to blow up somehow and not in a good way.
What I find interesting, and Jimmy Rutherford is very well-respected and has had a great career and lots of success, but he's taken some pot shots at, whether it's Bruce or, the coaching staff or the preparation of the camp and everything, and the team obviously is in a bit of disarray. They're not sure about what they're doing contractually. They can't make a trade. And he's kind of like lobbing, veiled criticisms or not so veiled criticisms. And I keep thinking, but like, aren't you the guy in charge? Like, isn't it kind of like eventually climb up to you if the direction seems to be confusing? And I think you're right. It feels like they're not sure what to do with Bo Horvat now. And if they can't sign him, then I guess they'll trade him. But if they can sign him, they might look to trade JT Miller. But they just signed JT Miller. And how bad is a contract that if it's 6 weeks old and it's completely unmovable, that's probably not a great contract to have signed originally. They're not in a good spot. And even whatever they end up doing, they're not good enough to win a Stanley Cup. They might be good enough to make the playoffs, but they're not going to be good enough to win a Stanley Cup. So that's probably the least desirable place to be, where you're not good enough to bottom out, or not bad enough to bottom out, but not even close to good enough to win it all, and you're just kind of stuck in the middle of treading water, which is where it appears that they are right now.
And also, Jimmy Rutherford, back to my junior days, MJ, is a hockey lifer. What do you wonder about the dynamic between him and the general manager, Patrick Galvin, who we never seem to hear from, and Jimmy has always been the guy in charge?
Well, yeah, I have no idea what the dynamic is, but it feels like Jim Rutherford's the boss there. We hear a lot more from him than we do most presidents, as opposed to the GM. So I don't know what the dynamic is. They have, Alvin's a GM. We don't hear from much from him. They have several assistant GMs. We don't hear a whole bunch from them. But you hear a lot from the president, which is not the norm, for hockey teams. So yeah, we'll see. And that's not the kind of market that kind of will just let these things sweep under the rug, right? Like they're gonna make issue of these things if they crop up.
Mm. Speaking of which, DJ Smith came to the defense of Nikita Zaitsev, who, as you can imagine, and when you're here from time to time, you understand that if there is a fan whipping boy that's been pretty consistent with the fan base and some in the media here, it has been Nikita Zaitsev, and he came to a pretty passionate defense yesterday of Nikita Zaitsev. I'll ask you as someone who's involved in broadcasting, but also someone who played the game. When you played in the Canadian market, when you played in Toronto and the short time in Montreal, do you find it over the top in terms of what when you're playing in a market, whether it was for you or teammates or anything, to play in Canada, or do you think it's fair? Like, where do you come at it?
So, I mean, I think I should obviously acknowledge that when I played, the lack of social media certainly changes the dynamic of the interaction for fans and players and media and players. Like, the ways you could reach out and touch a player were few. I mean, there was talk radio like we're on right now, which is actually not difficult to avoid, if you just don't listen to it. And there's newspaper articles. And, I guess you don't read the paper, you don't come across that often. It's just a little bit different now. I generally had a very positive experience of my time in Toronto and my time in Montreal. I never felt the kind of brunt of the ire of the fans or whatever. But, I was there with Larry Murphy, who was a Hall of Famer, who was booed off the ice every time he touched the puck, and then went on to have win two Stanley Cups in Detroit. So I saw it kind of firsthand when I was in Montreal. It appeared though Sergei Samsonov was a bit of the whipping boy for the for the fans for whatever reason. And it does, I imagine that would take its toll. Absolutely. I'm not saying it's unfair. You know, I think passionate fans, smart fans, they have the right to voice their displeasure, whether it's vocally at a game, whether it's on a message board or whatever, as long as it's not personal, as long as it's not about your family or something, if it just says Mike Johnson's a terrible player, Mike Johnson stinks, Mike Johnson, you know, can't score a goal, Mike Johnson's not very tough, whatever you want to say, that's, you know, it's not nice to hear, but it's fine. It comes with the territory. It's maybe more in some markets than others, but, you know, it's also guys are wired differently. Some guys would hear that stuff and it would very much bother them and they would take it home and it would stay with them. And other guys kind of would be able to shrug it off and not be as concerned about it. I appreciate what DJ was trying to do, defend his team, stick up for his guys. I imagine Nikita Zaitsev would appreciate that. But I don't know. Like, I'm sitting here on the media side. I don't think, you know, the media in Ottawa is particularly personally harsh. If the guy isn't playing well and the media points it out and supports it with stats and numbers and observations, it's kind of their job. It's the same way that if someone's playing well, they get praised with stats and numbers and observations. So, I don't, it's a tricky one because it's a reality, but I don't know if anyone's at fault and I'm not sure how it changes.
And what's interesting, MJ and JR, you'd agree, back in the day, the newspaper took a one-way shot there. And for a lot of the reporters that weren't around the team, you could just send that shot. Nobody could send back at you. Social media has opened that up. But also, and again, I think it's a walk in the park in Ottawa, but I'm also biased because I do this for a living, MJ. How would you compare Ottawa to, say, a Vancouver or a Buffalo? Because Vancouver in particular, I do think that that takes a whole different level where it has a major effect on the athlete.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I never played in Vancouver, but talking to people who played in Vancouver, who worked in that market, they all say it is more harsh, greater, stronger, more negative, whatever you want to phrase it, than just about anywhere. It might not have the same number of media members as Montreal or Toronto or New York, but the tendency for it to turn to a negative place is larger there. So I don't know. I think there is something to that, Simmer, where for whatever reason, if it just is so relentless, so overwhelming, so every day, I mean, I guess that would eventually take its toll on an athlete and how they feel about themselves and then their life and doing their job every day.
I guess is this just kind of, I don't know, country by country, sport by sport? Because I look at the way soccer is covered in Europe.
Oh, go play soccer in Britain. Good luck.
Well, that's my point, though. But is that just you kind of understand? And I guess to that, when we hear some athletes say, well, Canada's too tough, I guess that if you can play in the United States and still have a great life and the same money, where in Europe you have no choice but to go to the big clubs if you want to be a star.
Yeah. I mean, that's a valid point. And you have choices. If you do have a choice, you don't have to play. The same reason why I might not want to play in wherever. You know, I might want to play in Raleigh, North Carolina, because I don't want to live in Raleigh, not, you know, for any other reason. You have these choices that you can do that. But I always look at the other way, is that when you have success in a market that is passionate, the level of satisfaction that you might pull away from the rink is also so much higher. Your recognition, the people celebrating what you do well, it's so much higher that I look at it as like an upside. Like, I don't worry about the downside. Yeah, I guess it's worse when it's not going well, but when it does, can you imagine if you helped Vancouver win, or Ottawa, or Toronto, or Montreal, you would be celebrated forever. And like, that upside is also really appealing for athletes. I loved it in Toronto. I loved it in Montreal. So it works both ways. And I everyone focuses on the negative, but you have to also acknowledge the positive. If it goes well, it's also the greatest place to play by a long ways over several markets where it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, I think part of it is born, and just specifically here in Ottawa, by the fact that the Sens have been in a rebuild for what seems like forever, right? I mean, the 2017 playoff run was a bit of an aberration, but, you know, it's been for the better part of a decade now, a lot more losing than winning, and I think that just kind of feeds that whole narrative of, you know, it can be a negative place. Anyway, the reality of the situation for the Sens for the next month, it looks like, is no Zub. And for the time being, for the here and now, Zaitsev. Now, you saw him play Friday night at Madison Square Garden. He popped in and played again on the weekend, but losing Zub for now. They've already lost him for 10 games already this season, now again for another month. What's the impact on the back line from you?
Well, it's not great. I mean, it's been well documented. When Zub and Shabbat are in the lineup, their record's decent. Not great, but it's decent. When one or both are not playing, it's not nearly as strong. I think Simmer will be happy to hear that Zub's case to be a valued member of the future of this franchise gets strengthened whenever he leaves, because you recognize what you're missing, and that he is a steady Eddie, right shot, perfect complement to Shabbat, good, hardy defender, moves the puck pretty efficiently. But in a team that needs kind of like stability in their decision making and in their ability to defend around the front of their net, he does that. And he does that about as well as anyone that they have. And when he's not around, it shows itself in several levels, not just win losses, but you look at the way they move the puck out and the chances they give up and everything else. It's not as good when he is not available. So it's tough. I mean, and I guess we should acknowledge the toughness of him coming back in the lineup and finishing the game against the Rangers with a broken jaw. Like, he came back and played the rest of that game, which is amazing. Toughness and resiliency, and, you know, Hamonic showed some as well. But yeah, it's not great. And Zaitsev, they're trying to pump him up and build him up and hopefully he can step in there. But I think history has shown that it's going to be a drop off. And DJ talks about the need to defend or to play more with the puck so you don't have to defend. If you're already game planning how to minimize the impact of the new guy, tells you how confident you are in the results with the new guy in the lineup and the other guy out.
In the case of Zub, having a father like Ivan Drago also helps, I think, in that, in the healing. To that, MJ, I look at this month, a couple things. You boil it down. Going to need, based on the lack of depth up front on the back end, going to need two hot goaltenders, and you're going to need that power play we saw on Saturday night to kind of ride this out into the new year.
Yeah, I mean, everyone else has to pick up. Your team gets worse in some capacity, then the other areas have to get better. I mean, that's kind of how it goes. And the good news for Ottawa is they have the power play pieces that should be able to be better. Do they have the goaltending, Simmer? You're the goalie expert. That's a different question. The goalies have been, you know, Cam Talbot's actually on a nice little run here, but the goalies have been okay. They haven't been great, but they haven't been, you know, the best in the league either, and they might need to go on a bit of a hot run to kind of to allow them to withstand these injuries and try to creep back towards the playoffs.
You were at Madison Square Garden, did the game on Friday night, and there was the home opener versus Boston. I think has been a memorable game so far this year, and I think that one on Friday night for what Brady Tkachuk did was very memorable. Just kind of take us through what it was like to be there and kind of watch that tour de force that he put on.
It was awesome. Like, you know, and we're prone to hyperbole. We get excited. That's the greatest game. But that was one of the best individual efforts where you could tell kind of by the force of will, which is hard to do in hockey. Like, everyone wants to try hard, right? It's hard to just, like, you know, it felt like he was going to will his team back into the game, not going to let his team lead. We say stuff like that, but it's not really that true. In that game, it felt like it was, including the, at the time, I'm wondering, maybe somewhat ill-advised decision to fight, you know, in the middle of, right at center ice against Trouba, a hellacious fight. The points, the goal late, it was really something. Brady has shown himself to be such a good player this year, better than I thought he could ever really be. And to see a guy kind of be willing to lead in every way, and maybe that's part of what makes Brady so interesting, right? It is the fight, it is the turnaround and the challenge to the bench, but then it is to back it up with the goals and the assists and the production. I didn't think he had the legs in him, because Brady's not the smoothest skater to get in all the way on the breakaway and then to finish it. But, you know, whatever it was going to be required to try to win that game, he was going to do it. And hardly any players can try to do that, let alone pull it off. It was an exciting game. And it was when you walked out and you recognized, like, that game was special. That game was a unique statement game by Brady Tkachuk. Maybe one of the finest in his career. I don't know if he thinks that, but it felt that way in the moment. And given what was going on for Ottawa, given where they are and in the standings and what's happened and the need to kind of string something together, it felt timely, felt important that they would they could do it on that night and led by their captain. It was incredible. It was almost like you were excited watching it, whether you like the Sens or not. Like, this guy is doing something special tonight, and it was very nice to see if you're a Sens fan, but impressive for Brady to be able to pull it off.
Has it also been impressive, MJ, over the last 12 months to watch he and Stützle, how they've gone from very good to, you know, I won't go superstar, but it looks like you certainly have two frontline players and a couple of stars on your hand.
Yeah, you're right. And it's funny because they kind of got there differently, right? So Brady, I thought, was going to be what he was going to be, which is a very good, productive player, massive intangibles, leadership and toughness and intensity and emotion and all those things, and a worthy captain and really a guy you want around your organization. But I didn't think he would be an upper-end offensive producer. But he's grown into that, and he's grown his game. He's a better passer of the puck, and he creates more plays passing it around than I thought he would be able to. So good on him. And for Timmy, it was more, you know, he's going to get there, just not sure how long it's going to take, because, you know, he was so young, and it just took a while for him to kind of to mature and to grow and to get comfortable, to get strong and to play in the middle, which I think a lot of people appreciate how that has helped his game take off. I thought he'd get there. I thought he'd become a point of game player. When you envision this team at their very best, you thought he would likely be the leading scorer. And he probably still likely will be the leading scorer when it's all said and done. But he's also gotten there quickly and become kind of the 1-2 punch with Brady. And wouldn't you love it? Like two cornerstone pieces locked up long-term, who are whatever they are, 22 and 20. Like that's how you build your team. And it's been a nice, slow and steady progression, which is how it's supposed to go, but doesn't always work out that way.
LA Kings are here in town. You did the late night game, a Sunday night, a couple of weeks ago that Ottawa ended up winning in overtime on the Claude Giroux goal. And it's kind of weird. They're top five in the Western Conference right now. Now, they played pretty much more games than anybody else. Yet their goaltending, well documented, is, say percentage-wise, the worst in the National Hockey League this year. So how are they doing what they're doing with seemingly not very good goaltending?
They are a strong team with bad goaltending, right? Like, they don't give up a lot of chances. They give up a lot of goals because their goalies have not been great. They've had a couple wild games, but generally speaking, they're a pretty good defensive team. You know, they have a power play that goes at 25%. So they can produce offense on the power play. They're, you know, almost a top 10 goal for team. So they're scoring their way through their issues. And even though their goaltending is awful, their underlying numbers are decent. They generate more shots, more chances, more expected goals virtually every night. They have two really good defensive centermen in Kopitar and Deneau that can kind of roll out 1-2, and we'll see it tonight to try to match up against teams that have two offensive lines and try to take that away. So they're finding ways to get it done more with offense than with defense, and hoping that their goaltending sorts itself through. And I also think it's fair to say they're taking advantage of a division that has not gone the way that we thought it would, with Seattle jumping up there. Edmonton and Calgary and Vancouver have all struggled to varying degrees from what they were expected to do. So it's opened the door for LA to be in third place, even though they've played a third, you know, 27 games. But that's, yeah, it's really just based on kind of strength of offense and a strong team game to go along with bad goaltending.
How has Fiala played in L.A., and how much do they miss him in Minnesota? And I say that, MJ, because that was talked about last year in Ottawa here quite a bit.
He is exactly what he is paid to be, Simmer, which is a dynamic offensive player. You know, there's been already moments this year where Tom McClellan has kind of, like, called him out a little bit or shortened the bench a little bit, because there are moments when he might leave you a little bit frustrated. He likes to be an individual player, likes to try to, you know, take it on himself. But he leads them in points. I was, you know, prepping. I'm doing the game tonight in Ottawa. And amongst all players that switched teams last year, he's got the second most points behind only Matthew Tkachuk. Like, he is what he is an elite-level rush offensive producer. And that's what he's done. And that is something that L.A. has needed. And it's something that Minnesota is missing. He's not a perfect player, but, boy, he's a really dynamic one when he has the puck.
How much satisfaction would Bruce Cassidy have gotten last night from going into Boston and winning that game versus the Bruins?
A lot. Like, you know what I mean? Like, his life is obviously good. He's fine. He coaches one of the best teams in the league. He makes a boatload of money. He's exceptional at his job, but he's also a human being. He got fired despite great success from a team. Some of the players took some shots at him on the way out about the way that he was coached, whether you're Jake DeBrusk or whoever it might be, in the comments about the team vibe being better and opening things up. So to go back in there, it would have been personal. But to go back in there and break up the franchise best winning streak at home, that was at 14-0, given their first loss at home, would feel great for him. So, yeah, that would be one. I've not been around a lot of teams where it's kind of been personal for a coach. I've been around a whole bunch where it's personal for a player, including myself, when I would go back and play in Toronto after being traded away from there, whatever it might be. But not so much for a coach. And it was great to see how his team responded, got a standout goaltending performance, and got the win. He gave the closeted little high five when they finished it off, but I think inside he was like, take that, boy. Like, yeah. You know, that one felt good, and understandably so.
Would have been like Barry Trotz going back to Washington for the first time, MJ.
There you go.
Yeah, just thoughts on Jimmy Montgomery as well. You know, and again, I know Butchie would still say, man, original six, it was my favorite team. I was a Bobby Orr guy, but how cool has that been, and a great story in Montgomery as well.
Yeah, I mean, listen, neither organization should feel bad about where they are right now. They both obviously made the right choice. They're two of the best teams in the league. And Jim Montgomery has taken what Cassidy started and made them better, allowed them to change a little bit, open them up. And I think it's a great story for Montgomery, who was always acknowledged to be a very good coach, that he had to do some work to get other parts of his life to the place that he wanted to get them. But he did that work, and he's gotten that life back in order. And now he's thriving at his profession, which he's always been known to be great at. It's a really nice story for him. And he's taken a team that I think a lot of people were unsure of because of their age and their injuries, and he's turned them into, like, unquestionably, they're the best team in the league right now. Them and Jersey are the two best teams by a considerable margin, and I don't think it's an insignificant impact that Montgomery's had on their success.
All right, good stuff. Mike Johnson will be on the TV call tonight of the Sens and the Kings. Appreciate the time and the insight always, MJ, and we'll talk again on Thursday.
All right, guys. Have a great day.